Refugia, a podcast about renewal. Refugia are places of shelter where life endures in times of crisis. From out of these small sanctuaries, life re-emerges and the world is renewed. We're exploring what it means for people of faith to be people of refugia. How can we create safe places of flourishing, micro-countercultures where we gain strength and spiritual capacity to face the challenges ahead? I'm Deborah Reinstra, professor of English at Calvin University, and this is Refugia.
Over the past 15 years, we have come so close to passing bipartisan immigration reform that provides a pathway to legal residence for so many, all in some cases. And this is something that, you know, Republicans and Democrats have agreed on in the past. And I know that there are still a large amount of Republicans and Democrats who would come together and pass, a bipartisan immigration bill that would, you know, significantly improve, if not completely solve, this immigration crisis.
Hi, everyone. I am really honored that Hillary Skolton took some time in the midst of campaigning for Michigan's 3rd District congressional seat to talk with me about refugia. Hillary's broad perspective ranges all the way from inside the august halls of the U.S. Department of Justice to Michigan's farms and fields, where Hillary provided legal representation for migrant workers. Here's what I wanted to know. When it comes to creating refugia, especially for vulnerable people, does government policy have a role? Or is this all about changing hearts and minds on a community level? Hillary helps us think through those questions as Christians and as citizens. This is the last regular episode of the Refugia podcast. I hope you've had a chance to listen through the other episodes and look for our final summary episode too. And of course, as always, thanks for listening. Today I'm talking with Hillary Skolton. Hillary is an attorney who worked for the Department of Justice under the Obama administration and then moved back to Grand Rapids, Michigan, her hometown, to serve with the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. These days, she is running for Congress. She is a Democratic candidate from Michigan's 3rd District. Hillary's here to talk with me today about how policies and systems can prevent or encourage the kinds of refugia that help all people thrive. Hey, Hillary.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Deborah.
Thanks for being here today. So I would love to take at least a little of the credit for getting you and your family back to Michigan, since my department here, the English department at Calvin University, managed to lure your very accomplished husband to join our faculty and teach journalism here.
We're glad you did.
Yes. Thank you for working it out as a family so that you could all become part of this community again. Jesse's a really great colleague. We're just so glad to have him. And you have been diving in and serving this community as an attorney, and now you're very deep into it with this campaign for Congress.
Yes.
So how are you doing?
Doing well, actually. Yeah. A lot of momentum around the campaign. Feel like maybe I'm running on pure adrenaline at this point, but we're all doing well so far. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. So has it changed your life a lot?
You know, as an attorney also, you know, I come from experience of working long hours. So the day-to-day hasn't necessarily changed too much, though, make a few more phone calls now than perhaps I did before. So
got it. Yeah. So let's begin with your experience providing legal services to immigrants here in West Michigan. What did you do? What kind of folks did you work with? What was that work like?
Yeah, so we really did a wide range of work at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. As a statewide organization, we served a diverse array of immigrants. So, I did everything from working with migrant farm workers here in the west side of the state, helping families fight against wage theft, representing single mothers who had experienced sexual harassment in the workplace, advocating for fair and safe housing conditions for migrant farm workers, to representing Iraqi religious minorities who were trying to be deported under new policies under the Trump administration. Really wide-ranging effort of work over the last 2 years.
How has your faith motivated you in that work?
You know, just as you said, it has motivated me. Mm-hmm. It motivated a lot of my decisions to leave the Justice Department in 2016 when we were staring down the pike of some what I believe are truly immoral decisions. Mm-hmm. And I realized that, you know, my faith called me to different action at that mm-hmm. time. I couldn't stay and help support the policies of this president, which I feel, you know, is in direct conflict with the teachings of Christ, the example of Christ's life to care for those on the margins and, mm-hmm. you know, the explicit instruction to care for the foreigner among us, in particular. Immigrants have been, an acute target of this administration. And so for me, you know, it was a faith-based decision, as well as one, you know, I feel like there, as we see a lot of attorneys who agree with this, there's a lot of unconstitutional things happening under this administration. And I just mm-hmm. didn't feel, as an attorney that I could continue to support those policies.
So you noticed the change right away after the inauguration?
You know, I mean, I would say we saw a president who, you know, ran on a very specific agenda and, pretty early on began through executive orders and decisions directly from Jeff Sessions, who was put in charge of, immigration programs under the Department of Justice. We saw the directives changing. Yeah. Quite immediately.
He was your boss mm-hmm. for a while there.
Yeah, for a few months. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So you came here and then worked in this with immigrants here.
Yeah.
So what kinds of policies do we have in place right now that prevent the people that you worked with, the kinds of people that you worked with, migrant workers, immigrants, refugees, undocumented or documented? Mm-hmm. What kinds of policies do we have in place right now that prevent such people from thriving? As well as business owners and farmers and employers, this is all a big tangled mm-hmm. system.
Yep.
So are the interests of citizens and immigrants necessarily at odds? What's going on?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because I think, you know, to answer the last part of the question first, no. I don't think that their interests are at odds. And I think we see right now the policies of this president not serving either of those interests. Mm-hmm. Here in Michigan, 50% of our migrant labor population is undocumented. And that's pretty true, bears out to varying degrees, but it's pretty true across the board, across the country.
And what kind of agricultural products or industries are involved there?
Wide ranging. But so mm-hmm. here in Michigan, like particularly here in the 3rd Congressional District, heavy on apples, peaches up in the Ridge area. West Michigan, you know, we're known for our blueberries. That's farther out towards, the coast in the 2nd District. But we asparagus as mm-hmm. well. We have tons of dairy farms throughout the state mm-hmm. as well, and poultry farms, wide range of, farms and, mm-hmm. Agricultural product that draw migrant and seasonal workers mm-hmm. here. Not so much the dairy and the poultry, but the other, the seasonal vegetables, that bring people here on a seasonal basis. So those are mm-hmm. the types of products that we're thinking of that, involve mm-hmm. This type of labor, agriculture being a huge driving force for our state, of course. So it puts the workforce as well as the employers in a very precarious position.
Yeah.
The workers, of course, who I represented, who you see up close and personal, being just terrified to speak up about any violation of mm-hmm. their rights, be it wage theft, be it unsafe working conditions, mm-hmm. Unscrupulous labor practices, or, even sexual harassment, where individuals feel, I would rather endure these terrible conditions than face a potential consequence of being deported and separated from my family. Yeah. We are learning all too much about the atrocities of family separation that happen at the border right now, and the trauma that it will inflict on children and the parents themselves. Parents in the interior recognize that too, and it keeps them from coming forward and speaking up about their rights. And then, you know, it also puts the employers in a precarious position as well. We've talked to, you know, numerous farm owners who say to us, is there anything we can do? We do our due diligence of, you know, checking individual status, but, you know, we know also sometimes immigration and customs enforcement gets it wrong. Mm. And if they conduct a raid, it can be wide sweeping. And those warrants they issue don't have to be reviewed by a judge. So mistakes are made.
Yeah.
And, you know, people can get swept up in these raids who aren't necessarily the intended targets. And an employer then is looking at losing a large chunk of his or her workforce.
Yeah.
And that puts them, you know, in an extremely precarious position, particularly when you're talking about, crops that need to be taken off the field, off the trees, off the bushes, within a certain period of time. If you're losing, you know, a good slew of workers right at the peak of harvest, that's, you know, there goes thousands of dollars.
So everyone's in a state of chaos and insecurity and fear. And this is, as we say, not sustainable. So let's just pause with the way things are before we start thinking about solutions. And I'm curious, you know, what you wish all Americans understood about life on the ground as a migrant worker or refugees or immigrants. Those are three very different categories.
Yeah.
But with all the rancor and inflamed rhetoric in the air, what is the American public missing when it comes to immigration? You've seen it on the ground. What are we missing?
Mm-hmm. I really wish that we could come together and connect on the complexity of it all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we're missing. We're missing how complex this is. You know, it has been broken down into sound bites and tweets and memes and one side lobbying, you know, a carefully crafted zinger at the other.
And simplistic arguments.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it is so much more complex than that. It's not a problem we're going to solve overnight. And so, you know, I wish people would take a deep breath, be willing to consider real solutions for ending this crisis. I think that this is something that we can solve. You look at over the past decade, and even over the past 15 years, we have come so close to passing bipartisan immigration reform that provides a pathway to legal residence for so many, all in some cases. And this is something that, you know, Republicans and Democrats have agreed on in the past. And I know that there are still a large amount of Republicans and Democrats who would come together and pass, a bipartisan immigration bill that would, you know, significantly improve, if not completely solve, this immigration crisis.
Mm.
So, you know, I think we also need to, you know, remember that there are lives on the line. Has become, a debate that I think too often gets into treated sort of like any other policy decision. Not that those, you know, aren't also, you know, involving, you know, severity of treatment of lives. But, here we're talking about, you know, we've had numerous children die at the border in recent months. Every year there are thousands of deaths with people trying to cross the border. So it really, you know, it is a humanitarian crisis that we need to treat as such. And we should be responding to it with that level of severity.
And moral urgency.
Exactly.
It's not just about the blueberries.
Yep.
And the timing they require.
Exactly.
A moral urgency to it. Have you seen people who are living under these conditions finding places of refugia in some ways? This is our connection here now to our larger topic. Have you seen immigrants of whatever legal status find places of refugia for themselves and their families?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's no different from individuals who are, you know, immigrants recently arrived or, you know, immigrants from long ago or people who don't consider themselves immigrants. It's in community, community, with, you know, similarly situated families, communities of their church, communities of school. And I think one thing that this work has really taught me is the importance of community and our community here in particular, of recognizing these individuals, you know, regardless of their legal status, are living here. And, you know, we are sharing this space and these resources, and they are a part of our community.
So is it okay for people of faith to, whatever their worries about legal status, to be the people of refugia and to welcome these folks into community? What would that mean? What would it look like?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, there is no command in scripture against that. In fact, even as I mentioned before, you know, there's a very, you know, real command to welcome the foreigner against you. And there's no asterisk saying check their legal status first.
Yeah. Widows, orphans, sojourners mm-hmm. seems to be a very persistent theme.
Yeah.
In the Old Testament especially, but mm-hmm. it's certainly a theme in the Gospels as well.
Yeah.
Have you seen people of faith really step up and create these places of shelter, literal or spiritual, for people who are full of fear, who are in crisis in one way or another?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I see it in ways big and small. You know, I think we see the faith community has really stepped up and sheltered children who have been brought to our region for care under disastrous conditions, which, you know, I know personally a lot of families who disagree wholeheartedly with it, but it doesn't change the fact that the kids are here.
Yeah.
And, you know, people who have said, well, you know, it's not going to do me any good to sort of not open my home. What I can do is provide a space here for this child while this, you know, disastrous policy is taking place, and work with whatever I can to eventually help this child be reunited with their parents. Mm-hmm. And my organization that I work for, the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, we represented legally every child that was brought to the state of Michigan after being separated with their parent for foster care. And successfully reunited all of them. And it was, overwhelmingly seeing, you know, people of faith sort of stepping up and just really being changed by that whole experience.
So they too experienced a kind of transformation through being involved with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, it's, you can, you know, just disagree with this policy on one level, but when you are, you know, caring for someone else's child in your own home, you just realize again that issue of urgency, how urgent it is to just get that child back with their parent. So
amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. And, you know, churches stepping up. You know, I know at our church we've, you know, reached out and provided housing and, you know, physical needs for a number of refugees here who are transitioning. You know, strong people of faith like Dana Dahl at Treetops Organizations stepping up and creating whole new organizations to expand on this idea of community and belonging and welcoming. Mm, so
there's so much work to be done.
So much work to be done.
So much potential. Yeah. So let's think about the future. What did you learn from working at the DOJ and then from your more recent work as an immigration attorney about the importance of good policy and the potential for creating not just temporary places of refuge, but places of refugia where we've been talking about refugia as places that can be seedbeds for growth that spread, that create renewed and healthy communities. So not just refuges, but refugia. Mm-hmm. What kind of policies do we need that can help us do that?
Well, you know, I think even taking a step back and being broader, you know, I think the thing that I learned from my time, you know, working at the Justice Department is that good policy and making good policy takes time. It takes thoughtfulness. It takes deliberation. It's not crafted in late night tweets.
Oh, so this goes overnight. Against our urgency issue here. Yeah.
Well, it goes against, you know, the reactionary practices right now, I think, of the president. And so I think, you know, urgency to come to the table is where I would say, and to create, you know, perhaps not a system that will change overnight, but a, you know, here's a step forward. And then tomorrow we take another step and another step. But urgency to put our differences aside, and really solve this problem. I think it's considering a wide variety of perspectives on an issue, and talking to the most important stakeholders, in the issue, in, and who will be impacted by the issue.
Yeah. So how do you see government's role, so the role of policy, mm-hmm. in conjunction with the role of the activities of people of faith or the activities of regular citizens? So it's all part of a system, but what's the role of government policy in creating a larger culture mm-hmm. of sustained healing?
Well, you know, I think the policy provides a baseline, you know, and it's not the role of government to completely dictate every action of our lives. That's the work of community. And, you know, but at a base level, we need policies that respect human dignity. You know, we need policies that will protect vulnerable individuals within our community. We need policies that prevent taxpayer waste, which is what we, you know, what right now with our broken immigration system, you know, we're just hemorrhaging money. You know, we've sent billions and billions of dollars to this broken system at mm-hmm. the border. Mm-hmm. You know, the last several government shutdowns have been caused by failure to resolve immigration reform, which those shutdowns have cost the taxpayers billions and billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we need policies that, you know, at its very core, protect.
Yeah.
I think that's the first step. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I think we are far from a place where we can, you know, sort of begin changing hearts and minds on this very divisive issue.
Yeah.
But at its core, the government needs to protect protect individuals,
mm-hmm.
particularly, you know, extremely vulnerable individuals like children who come into, you know, our care and custody.
Yeah. So that creates perhaps some base conditions, as you say, a baseline out of which community and culture can do that harder work that government can never do
yep.
of changing hearts and
yep.
minds.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, let's shift to the climate crisis. Mm. Another one. Immigration is huge and important. It's worth spending time on, but
yeah.
this one is too.
Yes.
So
talking
what is
urgency?
Yeah, right. What is government's role in your mind in the major economic and cultural shift we're going to have to face
yeah.
in order to meet this challenge?
Yep. Well, you know, I think, again, this is where I would say, you know, my perspective, talking in very broad terms about the government's role in handling these very thorny issues, is that, you know, at a baseline, you know, the government has to protect, you know, the resources within its care, the environment.
Yeah.
You know, we can't deny that climate change is real any longer, and we need to act with urgency. So, you know, I think we need a dramatic reshifting of focus in our priorities in the government to focus on sustainability in all aspects of development. And, you know, I think that includes, you know, even though there's not a way to sort of change hearts and minds, I think you can incentivize everyone from
incentives, yes,
individuals and small businesses to do their part when it comes to, you know, reducing our carbon footprint, relying less on fossil fuels, reducing, reusing and recycling more.
Yeah.
So,
I like this idea that government policy, it doesn't create refugia. It doesn't create cultural renewal, but it does protect the vulnerable. Yeah. It can protect the vulnerable, and it does create conditions in which it's easier for culture and community to do that deeper soul work.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. You're in the midst of a hugely demanding campaign right now.
Yeah.
What are the most beautiful places of Refugia for you?
My home. My home. It's such an oasis for me right now in so many ways. I'm an early riser, so when I get up in the morning, the first thing I do is take a cup of coffee out to the porch, have some time in prayer and meditation, get ready to face the day.
You live right in the city?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I'm surprised how quiet it is at 5:30 in the morning.
5:30? My goodness. You are an early riser. And you have two boys at home and a dog and a husband.
Yep.
I'm glad that's a place of refuge.
Yeah. Like I said, at 5:30 before they all get up.
Oh, right. After that.
Yeah.
Utter chaos.
Yeah, exactly.
Hillary, I'm so grateful for the work that you do, that you have done, for your commitment to being involved in politics and in doing this difficult work. So thank you for being with me today.
Thanks so much, Deb.
This has been Refugia, a podcast about renewal. Find us on the web at refugiapodcast.com and leave us a comment. Send us your ideas about what Refugia means for you. You can also find me, Deborah Reenstra, on Facebook and Twitter at Deborah K. Reenstra.